Hello, and welcome back to the Avery Adventures podcast. This is our third podcast, and we've received lots of great feedback from you guys on the first two, so thank you. One of the main questions is how to get a hold of us. So on the web, we're at averyadventures.com. Our emails are tanya@averyadventures.com. Ryan's is ryan@averyadventures.com. And on social media, we're at Avery_adventures on Instagram and Avery Adventures on Facebook.
Our guest today is a writer, editor, videographer, engineer, and one hell of a bow hunter. Please welcome Darren Cooper.
Hey, thanks, Ryan. Tanya, good to see you guys.
Good to see you too. I hear you got back from the ATA show. Did you see anything exciting down there?
You know, it was, it's been a while since I've been down there. So there was lots of new stuff, lots of new faces. You know, lots of little products. I didn't see anything. Holy cow. Man, there's a lot of whitetail stuff there. So you really got to weed through the show and find some Western nuggets and stuff that you can use in your kit. But it was fun. Definitely had some fun seeing old faces and meeting friends and a few new people making contacts. It was a good show.
Yeah, I imagine it's predominantly a whitetail show. I would say probably 90% of it, I would guess.
Well, it's probably 70-30 or so, but man, the crossbow crowd was crazy this year. Virtually, you know, about every bow company out there has their crossbow line now, and everybody's putting a lot of effort in that, and that might be slowing down the compound archery side.
Do you think that is it geared towards tree stand hunters? Is there a lot of tree stand companies there, or is it mostly just...
Yeah. There's tons of that stuff. I mean, probably 75% of your hunting market and sales and companies are geared toward whitetail hunting, because that's where a lot of the big population in the U.S. is, back east or in the Midwest. And so, you know, they're crazy about hunting those deer. That's their number one animal. But, you know, there's a lot of cool Western stuff, too.
And knowing that you're a big Hoyt fan, did you shoot any other bows besides Hoyt?
I always shoot all the other bows. That's kind of one of the purposes. When I was an engineer at Hoyt, is we'd walk around and spend a lot of time looking at the other bows, kind of seeing what they were doing, evaluating performance and all that stuff. So I spent a fair bit of time, you know, on the other bows.
Did any of those bows knock your socks off, or anything exciting that you saw?
You know, there was a few pretty nice bows out there. PSE's new offering was a good shooting bow. I liked it. Prime has a pretty good bow. Bowtech. Those were the ones that I thought were, you know, kind of the better. And of course, the Hoyt shot really well too.
Was there anything new or up and coming that nobody's seen yet down there that you could think of that was exciting to look at?
As far as bows, you know, not really. It's kind of, I think development of bows has been slowed down by everybody's shift toward crossbows a little bit. You know, a lot of companies are making some small incremental changes and doing a few things here and there to jazz up their stuff or catch up. But there's kind of getting to be a lot of parity amongst the bow companies. So it kind of comes down to feel, you know, and what suits your personal preferences.
Right. You being a big bow guy. Bows are kind of a racket, man, because they're not like a gun. They're not like a some of the hunting stuff that keeps their value. A bow, after about 4 years, is kind of like an iPhone. It's just a battery. It's just a, you know, a paperweight. It's an anchor. There's nothing there for it. Would you suggest people buy a bow every year, or do you wait 2 or 3 years and buy a bow?
I think most people are probably plenty safe buying a bow every 3 or 4 years. Even a bow that's 5 years old anymore hasn't really, you know, become obsolete or anything. And I think some of that might start changing a little bit, although a big part of what drives sales in the archery market is new. So you're going to see those top manufacturers, you know, redesign their flagship bows on a yearly basis, just so they can get those guys, or give that guy that's waited 3 years something to buy, or the guy that buys a bow every year has something to buy and look at. So I don't know. It's definitely a little frustrating when you're one of those guys and your bow's worth, you know, a third of what it was when you bought it new after, you know, 4 or 5 years. But functionally, you know, there's not the gap that there was 10 years ago. So yeah, you can get away with it, and you're really not giving up anything per se on the performance side. You might have a little bit of feel, or there might be a new gadget or a gizmo or a feature that somebody will come out with, but you know, they're just not changing like they were.
Right. A lot of people don't know a lot of people do know your background of your writing and stuff, but they don't know that you were an engineer at Hoyt. What was your job at Hoyt at that time?
New product development, mainly. I spent a lot of time developing cam technology and invented the cam and a half system. That was something that was pretty interesting at the show, or, you know, since I hadn't been there in like 7 or 8 years, there's no one cams anymore. Cam and a half and binary technology has pretty much taken over the entire market. So I succeeded in killing the one cam.
So what you're saying is Al Gore invented the internet and Darren Cooper invented the cam and a half.
That's a fact.
That's awesome.
I don't know about the Al Gore part, but.
Well, that's awesome. Did you have anything at all to do with the carbon riser or the carbon riser when it came out?
I did. We were developing that in probably my last year and a half at Hoyt. So I had quite a bit to do with that, especially the pocket system and just working with the early cosmetics and, you know, getting things to work right on the structure.
Do you still shoot a Hoyt bow?
Of course.
Yeah, that was a loaded question.
Man, I'm a homer. I still have a ton of good friends there and you know, Hoyt takes good care of me. I left on really good terms with everybody there. So I still work with the design team a little bit and give them some feedback on products. And I'm real confident with the capabilities of their team. And I know how they're developing products and still think that they're really on top of the market as far as quality and the features that they offer.
What about for women's bows?
Hoyt's got really good stuff. They've always taken care of short draw archers, kids bows, things like that, stuff that'll grow with young archers. So they definitely keep a good eye on that. And they typically build better performance into their short draw products than a lot of other companies do. They just kind of scale down or actually take a big cam and rotate the module around and you end up losing a lot of performance when you do that. But wait, goes the extra mile and will actually shrink the cams and try to maintain as much performance as possible for the short draw archers because it's more important for them than anybody. So
nice.
What bow did you use last year?
I shot the Carbon Defiant 34.
Did you end up harvesting any animals with it?
Yeah, I took, you know, I didn't do a ton of hunting for myself last year. I spent a lot of time helping my friends, but I did manage to take a really nice mule deer in Montana. With the bow, shot great. It's really one of my favorites probably in the last 5 years as far as, you know, against all the competition. That Defiant 34 has been probably the best bow that Hoyt's made in the last 5 years.
Well, I know you're an upgrader. What are you going to shoot this year?
You know, the Defiant hasn't changed a whole lot, so I might play with the new aluminum Defiant. That's one of the bows that I really liked at the show that kind of surprised me how well it shot and how well it aimed and just felt in the hand. So I'm going to spend a little more time probably with some of the bows and before I pick. But I'm kind of toying with the idea of getting a target bow and starting to do a little bit of competing again.
Uh-oh.
So there's potential for that. But I'll probably do it in the bow hunter class. Just because my eyes aren't as good as they used to, and I don't have as much time to go compete with the big boys in the open pro division.
Gotcha. So if Hoyt didn't exist, what bow would you shoot?
I'd probably look to the bow that just shot the best, and felt the best in my hand. I'd probably be looking to companies like PSC and Bowtech first, because they're a little more established than some of the newer guys like Prime, but Prime's making some pretty good products as well. You know, there's a ton of companies out there, and it's Yak Terrier, but there's, you know, a lot of companies out there that are making pretty solid products. Durability issues aren't as much of an issue as they used to be. It seems like everybody's kind of gotten on the ball and taking care of those issues. So Matthews is making some decent bows. They don't tend to fit me real well personally, just due to the grip design, but they're getting really good performance. And obviously Matthews has a huge following. But
yeah, I was going to ask you about that because they seem to be wanting to get into the Western market a little more, but they seem to be like a bastard child in the Western market for some reason.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, there's a lot of dynamics that go into that with sales force and just, you know, kind of where they're based and some of that. So I think the Hoyts being in Salt Lake City and PSC being in Arizona and Bowtech being over in Oregon, and I think that kind of helps them stay a little more prolific on the Western market, whereas Matthews is back in Wisconsin, so they're a little more whitetail centric, just kind of the nature of the beast. But they're definitely, you know, they're pretty strong everywhere. They're out every year. They're one of the top two companies.
Do you miss working down there at Hoyt?
Every day, man.
I bet you do.
It was a great job, and the people's what I probably miss more than anything. But one of my best friends is still the engineering manager down there, and we try to get out and hunt together quite a bit and talk on the phone weekly. So it's not too far removed still.
Right. Have you dabbled in any stick bows, any trad stuff?
You know, I played around with, I actually trained with recurve quite a bit when I was competing. So I've shot a lot of, you know, traditional recurve equipment. I'm definitely thinking about going that direction soon on some elk hunts, because I just think it'd be a great thrill to harvest something with a longbow or recurve, and just kind of take archery back to its roots,
right?
And dial back some of the technology. And elk is really a perfect species, I think, for close range encounters. So.
Yeah, especially in North Idaho. That's one of the biggest reasons that I only hunted with a compound for 2 years of my life, and pretty much all of my elk hunting is with a bow has been with a recurve, and up here you're either 10 yards or you're a mile away, so I totally get that.
Yeah, there's plenty of close encounters I can think back on where I didn't end up killing a bull that if I had had a recurve, it probably would have been a much better option, and I might have been able to get drawn and get a shot. So, you know, I don't think it's as much of a disadvantage for elk hunters, especially in tighter conditions and thick stuff.
So how many days do you typically go out a year for? What is your hunting season like, whether you're hunting for yourself or with friends?
I try to hunt almost year-round. I hunt predators and wolves and mountain lions in the wintertime. As soon as that's over, got maybe a month gap and spring bear is open. So I spend a lot of time up, you know, in the woods in the spring. We do a big bear camp with friends here in central Idaho, and that runs until the end of June. So then it kind of have a little bit of time to start scouting, toward the end of June and through July. And, as soon as you know it, then, you know, this year I started real early. Well, I spent 13 days down in Nevada with a friend of mine on his mule deer tag. So it just kind of all rolls together. There's not a whole lot of off time. My last hunt of the year is usually, or for big game, is in mid-December in Idaho. There's some late archery seasons here that I always try to at least get a few days on. I'd like to do more, but usually by then my vacation's pretty exhausted.
Does your wife hunt too? I can't remember.
She does not. But her family hunted, and we've been together since literally the summer between 9th and 10th grade. So she pretty knew what she was getting into.
That's good. That's really good.
It is.
She loves comes from the a outdoors. Hunting family.
Yeah, she loves the outdoors and camping and backpacking and all that stuff. And she spends a lot of time up at bear camp with us. So
are your kids getting into it?
My daughter shoots and has expressed some interest in archery, but she's been so busy with other stuff. She's never quite gotten all the way in and into the hunting aspect, but one of her favorite things and many of her friends is, oh, I want to go up to bear camp. I can't wait till bear camp. And she actually met her current boyfriend in bear camp.
So do you approve then you had a chance to kind of like vet him a little bit and make sure he was legit?
Yeah, well, they tend to be, they know what you're capable of, so killing stuff. So
right. That's good. That's important.
Keep them in line. But yeah. It's actually a good friend of mine at Hoyt. It's his son. So,
oh, that's good.
To school right now at University of Utah, so she's down there close to him.
Yeah, you want to make sure your future in-laws aren't crazy.
Yeah, no, they'll be just fine. We just had dinner with them last weekend down in Salt Lake. So
nice,
good people.
Well, everybody knows knows about you're a very, very exceptional bow hunter. But what they don't know is you've written a lot of articles for several different companies. You've written for Eastman's, Rock Slide. You work for Western Hunter currently. Do you have any projects coming up you can talk about?
You know, just more stuff on the gun side. I've really gotten into long-range shooting game and precision rifles. Ever since they opened a wolf season in Idaho, it was pretty much right then that I knew I'd always been interested and fascinated by long-range game. I just never had time when I was competing in archery and filming hunts and stuff. So now that I've stepped away from that, there's a little more time to go play with and get another passion kind of in the mix. And so the wolf season led to all of that. So I'm having a lot of fun reloading and writing some technical articles with rifles.
Yeah, I saw the one on the 338 Norma Mag. That I've had experience with that, and I think it's a great round. It looks like it'd be good wolf medicine.
Yeah, it'll definitely reach out there and touch them with a 300 grain burger. It's a great cartridge, and I'm having a lot of fun with it.
How far have you shot with it?
I've had it up to 1,000 yards so far. I just barely started developing loads for it about a month ago. So,
what's the gun? What is it? Take us through the real build on it.
It's a Defiance Action. And I've got a Hells Canyon Armory custom barrel on it, a carbon barrel. And I had a wood stock on it as a temporary. And I've got a new Elite Carbon stock coming, folding stock that should be here any day. So I'm going to drop that whole package into that. And I like that because it'll be a little more portable. I can fold it up and stick it in my backpack. And then if I'm riding my snow bike into the hills for wolf hunt or whatever, and I eat it on the bike, you don't have to worry as much about banging something up.
What's your strategy on speaking of wolves? Are you going in and howling? You just going in and spotting or glassing them up, or what's your strategy on that?
I do a little bit of everything. One thing I've figured out from just spending a lot of time in the hills is the wolves seem to hunt a lot like we do. They hunt and travel a lot like we do. So you'll cut their tracks on the top of the ridges and stuff overlooking, you know, where deer and elk are wintering. And so you kind of got to be careful not to screw up the area and watch where you're traveling. Cause you know, if you're walking the ridgetop trails, that's where the wolves are going to be. So I try to watch those areas, and really listen for the howls and try to zero in on them. I'm not a great wolf howler, but I've definitely gotten a lot of responses and located them that way. But I like to try to move in close and see if I can spot them. Rather than try to just call them from long distance or anything like that.
Can you use electronic calls to call them in Idaho?
You can, I believe. And I actually bought one a while back because I think it was a Primos call, and they said they were going to have a library of a bunch of different calls, but it didn't really come to fruition, so I ended up taking that one back.
They have a library of like 3 calls?
Yeah. And it wasn't even, they didn't have anything for wolves. It was pretty much all coyote stuff, so. I ended up taking that back, and I just use I'll use predator calls sometimes, or I use a bugling bull game calls howler to howl at them and try to get a response.
Do you generally notice that they hang around elk or deer herds, probably elk more specifically, or not?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it seems like most of the wintering areas where I hunt, the elk and deer are usually in fairly close proximity. So I think they probably hit the elk a little more than the deer. I'm not sure exactly the biological reasons why that is, but I see more elk carcasses anyway. So I'm assuming, you know, more of those are wolf kills than anything else. But that's pretty much how I figure out where I'm going to hunt them, is I find those wintering grounds and then try to get up high in those areas and just kind of work from the top down and cover a lot of country and try to hear them, because they are very vocal and they'll usually let you know if they're there.
Yeah, this year when Brian Call was up here and he shot that wolf with his bow, they were pretty much howling every night. And if you would find a herd of elk and you'd glass them up, the next day you'd go in there and you'd see the elk tracks. And then sure enough, you'd find wolf tracks right behind them. And then they'd be howling on that ridge that you'd seen the elk on the day before. So, and you know, the elk stink so bad, I imagine they're pretty dang easy to follow.
Yeah, I would think so.
It's interesting to me how down there you guys can spot and stalk them a whole lot easier than you can up here. But I do believe the howling would work just as good probably anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got some real open country, so it does definitely aid. The wolf that I killed, I was able to spot from, probably 2 miles away. They were actually bedded down on a little bench. So if it had been thick timber, you know, we probably never would have known those ones are there unless they piped up. But it was mid-morning, and they weren't really howling or anything at that time. We just actually spotted them.
So you just glassed them up and moved in and shot them?
Yep.
How many
was like, just like a big buck. It was kind of different.
How many was there altogether?
I think there was 5.
Did you shoot a male or a female?
I shot a female, a mature female. I think she was radio collared, and I want to say she was 5 or 6 years old.
What'd she weigh?
I estimate it was probably a 95-pound wolf.
Nice. Yes, she looked pretty big. If you get on Darren Cooper's Instagram page, you recently posted that, so you can see a picture of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Big. I mean, it was kind of surprising when I got up to it and realized, you know, how big these dogs actually are. I was pretty shocked when I rolled it over and realized it was a female. I was kind of expecting it to be an alpha when I rolled it over, so.
Yeah, I think that's the general public at all. They don't understand what those animals are. And it's okay to have one dog chasing you, but imagine have 5, 6, 7 80 to 120-pound dogs chasing you. It's incredible.
Yeah. I don't think the elk stood much of a chance when they first introduced the wolves.
I totally agree. Speaking of wolves, I talked to you a couple times about your dog, and I was kind of interested that you actually take your dog hunting with you a lot.
Yeah. I've got a Yak Terrier, and I got her as a tracking dog. She's actually sitting over on the couch right now, but she's a little 23-pound terrier, kind of similar to a Jack Russell, but she's black and tan. And she's been my best buddy ever since I got her. She hangs out with me at work all day, and she's been on several elk hunts and had bulls bugling in her face at under 20 yards. And then once you take a shot, she's ready to take up the track. And, if there's ever a bad hit, she's there to make a lot easier to work with that.
The amazing part to me is you said that she does not bark. Like when you're calling in an elk or you're stalking on a deer, they don't bark until after the shot. And then she said she just goes crazy.
Yeah. She usually, like at the shot, when the elk spooks, she wants to go right then and chase it, but she will sit there patiently shaking, you know, feverishly shivering with excitement. I actually had to reach over and close her mouth one time because she started panting. Just I reached over and closed her jaw and had a bullet like 20 yards. But
how much actual training was involved to get her to sit like that?
One of the kind of unique commands I taught her was to hide when she was a puppy. And so I would make kind of a claw looking thing with my hand, and I'd tell her to hide, and she would put her head down on the floor and kind of lay flat. And so I just started doing that whenever we'd see animals and whatnot, teaching her to hide. And part of the hide command is, you know, don't make any sound. So I think that might've helped, but I got her in the field on her first elk hunt, probably when she was about 6 months old, maybe even earlier than that. No, she was only 4 months old on her first elk hunt.
Wow.
So I started dragging her around the woods early, and I think they learn a lot from just how you approach situations. You know, I'm, you know, real quiet, and I always tried to do a lot of my commands in whisper so that I didn't have to yell at my dog to get her to do what I want. I would just be able to say, you know, sit or, you know, hide or whatever, you know, in a real low voice. And first my buddies were like, what are you doing or whatever? But, you know, now it makes sense to them that when she's out in the field, I don't have to be yelling at her or anything like that. But I always keep an e-collar on her too, just in case she goes tearing off after an elk or something, I can reach over and hit a vibrate button or send a little shock or whatever to, you know, make sure she's responding.
Just in case she gets a little frosty, huh?
Yeah. That can happen.
Has she
do that to you?
Don't. Yeah, Tanya always wants to put a shot collar in me just to see if she can.
He gets really excited when I, you know, shoot an animal too. I have to like calm him down.
Yeah, I cannot. I try not to be exactly next to her or right next to her when she gets ready to shoot something because I lose my shit.
Yeah.
So, on your dog, has you had any success blood trailing?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, in that first 6 months, she probably had, I don't know, 10, maybe 12 different blood trails, you know, cause I try to take her out on some high success hunts and took her with several friends and stuff. So she got on the blood trailing thing right away. And that was part of the training too. And you can just start out by dragging a little piece of, you know, deer liver or something around on a hard surface and then giving them a treat at the end of the trail. And then you just gradually extend that to longer trails and tougher trails with less scent and they pick it up pretty quick.
So as soon as she hits the blood, she knows what she's looking for?
Yeah, she does. And actually I usually put a tracking harness on her. And as soon as I pull that out of the pack, she knows what I only use it for tracking. And she knows exactly what's going on and gets real excited and just, you know, loaded with energy.
What's the longest blood trail she's found? Or is there an animal you don't think you would have found without her?
There's been a couple of real tough tracks that she's worked out. One of them was actually relatively short, but there wasn't much blood. And it was in really deep, high brush in the dark. And it was wet and kind of rainy. That was over in, where was that? That was Idaho. And then I shot a deer in Montana that was turned out to be a pretty tough track. It was probably 3/4 of a mile in the dark. And she made short work of that one too. And I think that would have been a really tough track because we were taking it slow, trying to just verify that we were on the track and trying to find blood. We really couldn't find, you know, hardly anything. And it got dark on us and she worked it out and went right to it. It was just kind of a trust thing, you know, trying to figure out if, are we on the right, you know, trail? Cause there was tons of other deer around and that's something that, you know, a tracking dog's got to learn to work through is, you know, there might be a fresh deer or a hot deer track that runs over the top of a blood trail that's 3 or 4 hours old and they've got to learn to discern the difference and stay on the right track. So.
Right. Do you notice that you have any trouble with her overnight or do you take her backpack hunting?
Oh, no, she's great. She snuggles up in the tent and finds a spot, you know, next to you on your sleeping pad or whatever. I usually bring, you know, I've got a down hoodie or something a down hoodie that I bring and I'll wrap her up in that if it's real cold, but she's good in the tent. You know, she'll let you know if something's out there. If a deer's walking by, she'll usually do kind of a low growl or, you know, if you happen to be in somewhere where there's other hunters, she'll usually let you know if somebody's walking down a trail close to you, but she's great about the tent. And,
so how long did it take you just like with the actual commands and stuff to train her? Do you think estimate?
You know, she's super smart. So she picks stuff up really fast. I mean, right when I got her, I spent about 5 minutes hanging a bell on the door, a couple of the doors in the house and teaching her that when she wanted to go out, she had to paw that bell on the door. And literally by the end of the day, she was doing that every single time she wanted out. So that got to be annoying real fast, but it worked. But it worked. So it really sped up like potty training and stuff. But, you know, as far as the hide commands and stuff like that, it's not a whole lot different than teaching them to sit and stay and come. You know, that stuff comes pretty quick to the dogs. And those are the important stuff right off the bat is to get those basic obedience commands, you know, taken care of. If you want to do something like hunt with your dog on a big game hunt, they've got to be, you know, razor sharp on that stuff or they're going to end up blowing opportunities for you.
Right. That's crazy. I didn't really, what kind of dog is that again?
It's called a Yak Terrier. It's spelled J and then A with the two dots, like Jägermeister. And then, so it's J-A-G-D and then Terrier. And they pronounce it Yak Terrier.
And I talked to you before, they don't shed.
No. Well, I've got a rough coated one So she's got a little bit longer wiry hair, and they don't seem to shed at all. She doesn't shed. I've heard the smooth coats will shed a tiny bit, but not like a lab or, you know, any kind of a long haired dog with an undercoat or anything like that. I've had plenty of dogs that shed. And so it was definitely one of my criteria.
Oh, for sure, a dog that didn't shed.
And I also love the size. She's only about, like I said, 23 pounds, 24 pounds. And so, you know, she can sit in the truck. She can, you know, fit in anywhere.
You can put her in the backpack.
Yeah. If she got hurt out in the field, I could throw her in a pack. Right. She doesn't like that very much, but she rides on my dirt bike with me, or the snow bike or whatever. She just sit on the tank. And at first I used to clip her in, to my chest strap on my backpack into a harness. But now she just rides and she balances and does her own thing. Once in a while, I got to throw a leg up or something to get her back kind of centered on the tank. But she'll come running up and just jump on the bike with me, and she's ready to go.
Now we've got to see her. You've got to pan over to where she's at.
Yeah.
Aww.
It looks like a terrorist.
Yeah, she is. She didn't brush her hair this morning, but she's got some serious
chompers.
I've got my wolf skull sitting over here, and for a 23-pound dog, her teeth are disproportionately large, you know, compared to what the 95-pound wolf's teeth are. So they're not as big, but they're close.
Those terriers are just tough-ass breeds.
Yeah, they are. They're a hard dog, and all the research I got or did ahead of time on this dog indicated that they're a very hard breed, something along the lines of a Rottweiler or something like that. So you have to use those types of, you know, enforcement and training up front and let them know right away that, you know, every human is an alpha to them, and, right, and, you know, never to show any kind of aggression. And I haven't had any issues whatsoever. Her temperament is, you know, similar to somebody's dachshund or whatever. She's, you know, she'll bark if somebody comes to the door or whatever, but she's never been aggressive. She's a little aggressive toward other dogs, even though we socialized her as a puppy. And I think that's probably just from, you know, little dogs tend to be aggressive too, because they're scared of stuff.
So right.
They've got after her a couple times or whatever. And so now when she sees a little dog, she instantly wants to kick its ass. But other than that, she's great with, you know, if you take her to the park, she's going to go up to the biggest dog there. It could be a mastiff or whatever. And she's going to go up to it and say, "Hey, what's up, dude? You and me." So
that's awesome. That's
nice.
Kind of her attitude. But yeah, she's been awesome. And all my buddies that hunt with her love, you know, having her along, and just the extra cuddles and just fun times. She gives us a lot of laughs.
Have any of your friends bought that breed now that they've seen what she's capable of?
Two of my friends have actually gotten dogs from the exact same breeder. So
nice.
Darren said he's going to breed her, so he might have some for sale too.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. She's probably going to be a mom sometime next year. So
nice.
Have some pups. Yeah.
That'd be cool.
All right. Well, on the dogs, I recently watched your one of your old videos, Double D Archery, or what was it called?
Yeah, Double D Bow Hunting.
You guys have any more? You have any filming in the future? You're done.
You know, I might. My ex-partner, John Dudley, I just spent some time with him last weekend. He's doing really well with Knock on TV. So he kind of took Double D and then spun the brand and basically kept the exact same concept. And
have you been on there?
Some of the early episodes. John and I did a brown bear hunt on the Alaska Peninsula. And I think there's maybe one or two other episodes where I was on, but every once in a while we do a hunt together, and of course he'll film it. And so I'm still on there, but John was a partner of mine on the U.S. archery field team in 2000.
You're on the U.S. archery field team?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The team won a
dude. You're like a goddamn onion, dude. You're just full of layers.
You're just like everywhere.
Yeah.
So yeah. Is that John Dudley with Knock On?
Yeah.
So you've been on that podcast before?
I haven't actually been on Dud's podcast.
Well, what the fuck?
He's done a pile of them. So,
but, well, he don't love you no more, apparently. When I was sitting there thinking about who would be great on a podcast, I was like, Darren Cooper. So John Dudley, you fucked up. You should have had him on first.
Yeah. See, Dud, you could have had me for let Avery pop my cherry.
Yeah, I didn't think you'd do it because you're so reserved and mellow, but I should have figured.
Hey, you popped his cherry, though, with the skinny jeans, the stretchy skinny jeans.
There you go.
Let's not say skinny jeans.
No, his aren't skinny.
Because I'm a fat kid. But last year, down at the Western Expo, I ran into Darren, and I was like, you know, looking at his butt, and I was like, Darren, why do you have those skinny jeans on? He's like, dude, these are the best jeans ever made. Well, then he pulled on them and they stretched. I don't know if you guys ever wear cool pants, but he stretched like cool pants. And I was like, huh. So Tanya had to find out what they were. And they're American Eagle, basically pajama jeans.
Yeah, they are. They are great. And then I did a little research and found him a relaxed cut of they're called Extreme Flex.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. And so I was like, oh, yes, this is perfect. Now I can get them out of the cool pants. Nothing wrong with cool pants, but when you wear them every single day, they get a little old.
So yeah. Basically, Darren.
Love my skinny jeans.
Darren invented the cam in half, and he's bringing back the skinny jeans, stretchy jeans.
Yep.
Yeah.
Actually, I hated jeans because I got a big butt and fat legs. So every time I wore jeans, you know, you can't lift your leg because you're fat. You try to lift your leg and it catches, or you try to hike around. Like people hunting with Carhartts, they got to weigh 50 pounds because if I wear Carhartts, man, I'm going to have such a rash, I won't be able to walk for a week.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, I've got big quads and stuff. So if you get pants that are regular jeans that fit your legs, your butt sags and your wife's like, why don't you get some jeans that fit you? So my daughter actually is the one deserves a credit for the stretchy jeans because she bought me the original American Eagles, but now I got a couple different pairs. So
now you're styling and profiling.
What's your daughter's name?
Brooke.
Brooke Cooper started a revolution.
Yeah, brought skinny jeans to the whole hunting industry.
Yeah, well, she brought skinny jeans to the fat kids.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So thanks a lot, Brooke, because Tanya always wants me to wear jeans. I don't wear them.
Yeah.
Now I do.
Well, I just don't want him to look like he's trying to be 60 when he's not 60. It's important.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure your wife tells you the same thing. You know, when you start to dress like an old man, when you're not an old man, you're like, dude, come on. Can we go out in public with you looking not like you're homeless?
Yeah. Now you can look good and be comfortable at the same time. It's great. I got to admit.
All right. We can stop talking about skinny jeans.
Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
Next thing, we'll start talking about flat bills and shit.
Can't do it.
No, me neither. If you have a flat bill, you just look goofy. I can't help you.
Yeah.
So, I guess this is I'm imagining we're gonna have a lot of gear heads following us. So, tell us a little bit about your backpack last year and what you had in it.
Geez, lots of stuff in my pack. I usually haul a lot, probably more than a lot of guys. I've just always packed a lot of camera gear, so my pack tends to be pretty heavy. Last year, I used a Sitka Bivy 45 pack. My second year using Sitka packs, they work pretty good for me. I've always got a down puffy. That's kind of my go-to piece of gear whenever I'm, you know, in the hills. I got to stop and glass for a couple hours. I got to have that down puffy. That's like my lifeline. You know, shit goes bad, you got to stay warm somehow. So, had the Sitka down puffy, you know, the rain gear stuff. I'm also running Sitka there. I think it was a dew point, rain system.
Is the dew point the light one or is that the cloud burst?
It's light. I think. It's real light and packable. The set that I've got, and that's key because otherwise you end up leaving it behind, and then eventually that's going to bite you. Weather changes fast in the hills, especially when you're packed in elk hunting or something, and you don't, you know, it might start out a bluebird day, but you don't have access to weather forecast in the places I go. So,
right,
gotta have that stuff with you. I pack a huge water bladder. I'm a total water hound, man. I sweat my ass off, so I bring a 6-liter. I can't remember who makes it. It's a big heavy duty bag though, because I've had some of those fail, and it's got like a almost like a Cordura exterior, really tough. But yeah, a gallon and a half of water that I pack on hot days. So
that's a gallon and a half.
A gallon and a half.
Wow,
dude.
That's like 12 pounds of water.
Yeah, I sweat a lot, get dehydrated easy. So I don't know. That's pretty key. Havilon knife. I love how light they are. I've got the bigger one though. The Piranha's the small one. I've got the Barracuda blade. I was able to do a whole moose in Alaska with that. So really like the Havilon blades, and that Barracuda's a lot tougher. You don't break blades very often, and it's a lot longer, so you can bone out meat with it a lot more efficiently. So
I actually ran the Piranha 2 until last year. We shot two elk together. My buddy had a Barracuda. Man, you can take off some big hunks of meat quick. So I switched to the Barracuda also.
Yeah. And they seem to, those blades, I think they're a little thicker and they just stay sharp longer, man. So like cutting through a moose hide or whatever, they'll a lot less blade changes, and inevitably, you know, you forget to bring a new blade or whatever. They just keep going a lot longer. So I like it.
What would you say you'd get at like doing elk? Do you go through a blade and elk, or blade and a half, or one blade, or?
Yeah, if I'm running the Barracuda, I can do it in one blade typically, you know, whereas a Piranha, I'd probably be running two blades, maybe even a third, you know, by the time you're like caping and stuff like that. So, and a lot of times I was breaking a lot of blades with my Piranha. So
gotcha. And here's a shameless plug. We sell the Piranha and the Barracuda on Rockslide.
Cool. Yeah. Other than that, some of the lightweight game bags, the new synthetic ones that are out. There's several brands out there, but those are just a lot better than the big bulky cotton heavy stuff that you know, we used to pack, clean up easier. You know, they're really strong. You can hang them on trees and stuff, and they'll take some abuse. Optics, I'm using a Swarovski 80mm spotter. It's actually one of the older ones, but the green model. Swarovski 1556s for all my mule deer hunts. And then I use a pair of Zeiss, I think they're Victory 8x40s for elk hunting, because I just don't need the big glass for that, and saves a pound out of my pack, or, you know, from around my neck. So bugling bull game calls, my go-to stuff. I use the Brown mouth reed. I don't do external calls. You can learn to use a mouth reed efficiently, you're going to be a way more successful elk hunter.
On that note, I think that if you can use your own mouth reed, you sound unique to you, and those bulls haven't heard you. You know, if you're using a Piccolo Pete from Primus or Hoochie Mama, they've all heard that. Or if you're using really any external call, they pretty much all sound the same, to where I think a mouth reed sounds unique to you.
Yeah. So a lot less motion, you know, you're not picking stuff up to your mouth, stuff's not getting caught in the reed, and you're sounding like a duck quacking every once in a while. So I've just had awesome luck with the bugling bull game calls. They're definitely my favorite. But one of my favorite new products this year was the Quivalizer from Trophy Taker. That company actually split. So Trophy Taker sold off. Dan Evans sold off the rest business and the broadhead side of it to another conglomerate. And then he's running with the Option Sight company and the Quivalizer company separate. And that thing's awesome. It lightened up my whole bow with the Quivalizer on the front. If you don't know what it is, it's a stabilizer and quiver in one. Basically mounts to the front of your bow where your stabilizer would. You can offset it. So I don't need an offset stabilizer anymore, because the quiver does that. I don't need a stabilizer separate from quiver anymore. So I've probably lost a good pound off of my bow, and it actually aims better because it's got substantial length out front that's more similar to a target bow. And there's a side mount that you can slap it on, but I don't even use that because I've spent 20 years packing around a target stabilizer, so that's kind of second nature. So I love that thing. It's a great addition to my hunting setup.
I seen that thing. It doesn't get caught up, and it doesn't like cumbersome, you know, difficult to pack around.
Not really. Cause when you're packing it just kind of goes up behind your arm, and just like my target stabilizers would. And I usually take it off if I'm like you know, strapping my bow to the pack, and I'll jam it down in one of the side pockets and then throw a strap across it. But pretty slick. I really, really liked packing that thing around this year compared to a traditional quiver and stabilizer combination.
I seen you move to pretty much all Sitka. How come?
Just a good opportunity to work with a different company and really like their products. Their camo works really good for me. Before that, I was using the Kuyu stuff and really no complaints with their product. Really good stuff, but I'm extremely happy with the Sitka gear. Virtually every piece of it that I've used has been a real hit. The one thing I had to modify a little bit was their bino harness. I thought it was a little difficult to get glass in and out, so I did a little surgery on that with my Barracuda Havel. There's kind of a divider in there. I cut that out and made a few other modifications. And I actually saw their bino harness at the show, and it looks like they've made similar changes to it. So removed some of the excess parts that made it kind of tough to get your glass in and out of it smoothly. So just really good, solid products and nice people to work with. I've enjoyed some conversations with those guys, and they take feedback really well. And they got just a tremendous broad spectrum of gear. Their beanie and neck gaiter, if you haven't seen those, or I should have mentioned those when we were talking about my down puffy, because that's my other two pieces of absolute must survival gear. Especially when it gets colder, man, you can throw those on, and I can be running my razor for lions when we're hunting, and be 10 degrees out and the wind blowing like crazy, and we're doing 35 miles an hour in the razor with no windshield and stay warm with that stuff on. So it's really well made, and their Windstopper and Gore products in them are top notch.
Yeah, I really like Sitka and First Light for that reason. They take feedback well. They're not, you know, the designer doesn't get irritated that you're trying to tell him something that they designed. It wasn't perfect. So I like that about those two companies.
Yeah. They've been great to work with.
All right, Darren, where can people stalk you?
You can find me on Instagram at Darren_Cooper. And then I've got a Facebook page too, just under my name, but I probably spend most of my time on Instagram, you know, posting a few pictures here and there, and actually should have a website up pretty soon. So if you do a web search, you should be able to track that down probably within about 30 days.
What's it going to be? What's the URL?
I haven't decided yet. So we'll come up with a name and we'll try to post that on my Instagram page so people can catch up to me there.
Yeah, you can get on there and you can see the dog and the wolves and what Darren's up to. And he takes some great photos, especially if you get on there and check out his mule deer with the skyline behind it. It was an amazing photo.
Yeah, that was my buck from this year. It was a good one.
All right, Darren, I'll have you on again. And we'll talk bows, just bows, because I know you have a ton of knowledge in that area. So I appreciate it.
All right, bud. Appreciate you having me on. It's been fun.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care.
Later.